I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
On today's episode, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jim Murphy. Jim is the Dunavant Professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Memphis. And he's going to talk about brief motivational interventions and how he's applied and extended this in populations of college students.
Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noah. Thank you, Sam. Great to be here.
Yeah, glad you're here.
Really excited to have you on. Big fan. As we do with all of our guests, we like to start off our show a little bit by having you tell us a little bit about your background and training history. So if you could be so kind as to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I got my undergrad degree in psychology from Seton Hall University, which is in New Jersey, where I grew up, and then made the long trek down to Alabama to go to Auburn University for my PhD in clinical psych, where I had the great fortune to work with Rudy Vucinic and J. Lee Tucker. And although I went there more interested in schizophrenia research, I left there incredibly passionate about addiction research, and then further pursued that passion at Brown University, which is, of course, the mecca for addiction research training, as Noah can attest to, and got to work with Nancy Barnett and Suzanne Colby and Peter Monti and a bunch of others, trainees as well that I still collaborate with, like Brian Borsari and James McKillop at the CAS postdoc. I spent 3 years there and then got a faculty job here at the University of Memphis, which is where I've been since 2006.
Yeah, you became a Southerner over the last...
I did, yeah. I've lost some of my jersey. Yeah. I'd like to think I've lost the parts that I've wanted to lose.
There you go.
Although I still curse more than I probably should. So that's the part that's hard to drop.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that's just woven into the fabric, I think, of being from Jersey, right? Or being from the Northeast in general. I think it just requires a certain amount of curse words per day. I think that's been my experience with the Northeast, right? It's like it requires me to toggle between, various versions of myself, some of which are the worst versions, right? Like in the traffic or like that kind of stuff.
But the South is nice because the nice day-to-day niceties here have softened me in a good way. Mm-hmm. And I just have to reacclimate when I visit my family up north. But, I think I prefer it here, to be honest. Other than the food, I miss the food in New Jersey.
I thought that was going to go the other way. I thought the barbecue down there was gonna sway you, but
I mean, I love the barbecue, but the bread, any bread products in New Jersey, whether it's bagels or pizza or
that's true,
or you know, sandwiches, the bread is just out of this world. So
wow, it's different bread. It has allegedly it's the water.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the water and like it's got the perfect humidity level. But I'm getting hungry just thinking about it.
Me too, and it's right around lunchtime here. Well, Jim, don't you know, blame yourself too much for your language, because I think everyone, no matter where you're from, has been wanting to cuss a little bit more over the last few years.
Fair. That is really fair.
But anyway, thanks for giving us that introduction to your training history. And we're really excited to have you talk about brief interventions today, primarily. And as you're aware, and you know, hopefully as the listeners are aware, this is going to be the first in a three-part series of intervention and treatments that we have available for people who, you know, struggle with different forms of harmful substance use. And we're sort of going to go from maybe the lower end of the intensity spectrum to sort of the highest. And so we're starting with brief interventions today. And a lot of your work with brief interventions have revolved around working with college students. So could you tell us a little bit about this population before we dive into what these brief interventions are?
So that's a great place to start. And So college students, and I would say young adults, the young adult population in general, it's sort of the perfect storm of risk. You have neurodevelopmentally mediated high levels of impulsivity, low levels of self-regulation. You have an incredible kind of need for social affiliation and forming close social bonds. You're in situations where you're meeting new people, and one of your primary developmental goals is to connect with those people, right? And so alcohol just fits perfectly into that developmental recipe, right? There's also this newfound freedom. There's the ability to access alcohol and other drugs for the first time, either legally or by virtue of being friends with people who could legally access alcohol. So it's not surprising that you get really high rates of drinking among young adults. And you get really severe consequences that could come from that, right? But you also get really significant positive effects. So that, I think, is the crux of the problem, is that you simultaneously have a lot of potential risk, but also a lot of benefits. And then for most young adults, they successfully navigate this process and this developmental period without a lot of permanent or really significant negative outcomes. So there's this perception that it doesn't really matter, and this is just college, and this is what you're supposed to do. So motivation to change or even to consider or want to have a conversation about drinking is low, but yet at the population level, risk is high. There's a lot of people who experience permanent negative outcomes, whether it's, you know, poor grades or an accident or a legal charge or an injury, or for some, a sustained pattern of heavy drinking that started in this period. So it is, I think, one of the real challenges in our field is how to reach people who don't necessarily want to make a change.
Yeah, absolutely. These are your sort of hot, moderate, maybe to high risk individuals who have low motivation to change. And so, I think our field has spent a lot of time trying to understand like how to approach these people. A lot of our attention has, you know, been spent on more severe populations, but there's a good portion of us that have worked on this solution. So can you talk to us a little bit about what that solution is as it stands now, brief interventions?
Yeah. So let me first start by saying that prior to about the year 2000, the way that colleges and universities and other venues that came into contact with young adults who were experiencing risk for negative drinking outcomes, you know, whether those were in juvenile correction settings or other places where you contact emerging adults, the dominant paradigm was to take adult models of addiction, you know, most notably, AA or 12-step models, right, or general sort of disease models of addiction, and apply that to try to motivate young people to drink less. And not surprisingly, that was a complete failure, right? Because the approach was to come with a message of fear that, hey, if you don't stop drinking like this, you're going to develop this really severe alcohol problem, right?
Yeah.
I remember when I was in Auburn in the year, it might've been 1999 or 2000, meeting with the counseling center folks at Auburn and having a discussion about how they approach students who had an alcohol policy violation. And it was to show them a video called Eddie Talks, which is about an actor playing a college student who describes this descent into daily drinking and really severe alcohol use disorder, right? And again, that does happen sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. But that is the real minority of young adult drinkers. And when a student, even if it was their first month drinking, right? Let's say a first year student who might've had their first binge episode, they're shown a video that basically suggests if you don't straighten up and stop drinking, you're going to turn into, you know, at the time they would say, and I'll use this term in quotes, an alcoholic, right? Which is a term that I wouldn't use now, but that was in the video, right? And that was sort of the message. So so at Auburn, I was fortunate enough to have a grad student colleague, John Davidson, who had been an RA at UW, University of Washington. And he worked with Alan Marlatt and Mary Larimer and their group. And he had worked on the First Basics trial, which is a brief alcohol screening and intervention for college students. It was a approach that Alan and Mary and John Baer and others had developed, Daniel Kivlahan. And they, instead of coming with this message of fear and you're going to develop this really severe alcohol problem, they sort of recognized that we need a more developmentally appropriate approach to have a conversation with young people that is more accurately geared towards their level of drinking, right? And the role that drinking plays in their lifestyle, which is generally not a role of physical dependence or strong cravings or, you know, any of these sort of signs of a more serious alcohol use disorder, but instead is a role of social facilitation and self-regulation and skill development and autonomy. And so they developed this basic approach. John Davidson worked with them. He brought this manual that they were nice enough to share to Auburn, and we started providing this service in our psych services center. And so the basic approach that has been since that point tested in just dozens and dozens of clinical trials is to A, conduct a brief assessment where you figure out or ask about the young adult's drinking pattern, how much they drink, how often they drink, and what sort of consequences or experiences they have when they drink. And then maybe some other risk factors, like whether or not they have a positive family history of alcohol use disorder. You might ask about how much money they spend on alcohol. And then you take that information that they provided and you use that to structure sort of a non-judgmental, open-ended, motivational interviewing style conversation with the young adult, where you really legitimately make an effort to understand what they like about drinking, what they get from it, what are the good parts about drinking, and then also what are the things they don't like as much about drinking. And we try to get really specific about both of those. And the other sort of overarching goal is that you establish a relationship, you know, and to the extent that's possible in a 50-minute interaction, you try to establish a relationship, you try to put the person at ease, you try to start by telling them you're not going to judge them or tell them what to do, and that this is really just a chance for them to have a conversation about drinking and what, you know, their thoughts about it are. And then you move into the feedback where you talk about, you know, you provide them with a summary of the information that they provided you. So one of the things that's always striking about that is that even though all the information you provide to them in the feedback came from them, when they see it aggregated in this chart and with this, you know, these numbers, it's often completely like a revelation to them, right? They'll say, wow, I've never really taken the time to think about how many drinks I have in a week. And when I see it this way, I feel differently about it, right? Or, you know, I've never thought about the fact that I've had all of these different things happen when I drink, that I've blacked out and then I've gotten into arguments and I've gotten into fights, right? And so that sort of starts that the dialogue that often culminates in their expression of a desire to make a change.
Yeah, well, and one thing that, you know, you've talked about a lot already is that this is sort of a conversation. It's about them giving you information, you aggregating it, giving it back, which is a sort of stark contrast to the picture that you presented of how this used to go, where someone was mandated to come in. Maybe this was actually their only perceivable, you know, at least at the time, perceivable consequence was getting caught, you know, right. drinking. And then they're shown this video basically telling them all of the bad things that will happen. And a big part of that you mentioned briefly is this motivational interviewing style. Could you talk a little bit more about what that is and about how that sort of shifts the feeling in a session?
Yeah. So motivational interviewing was, you know, developed by Bill Miller and Steve Rolnick, and really is a way of communicating with people where your primary goal is to understand more about their view about a particular issue, right? So motivational interviewing starts with eliciting from the person who you're talking with their thoughts and feelings about whatever the content is that you're going to meet about, right? And I guess to step back just a little bit, maybe the real foundational element is some agreement about what it is we're going to be talking about, right? So in this case, we're going to be talking about alcohol, right? And maybe how it fits in with your experience of young adulthood or college, if it's a college student. And so there's some agreement about the nature of the conversation. And then motivational interviewing is about asking open-ended questions to elicit from the individual their thoughts about their drinking, what they like about it, what they don't like about it, and to try to reflect what they're telling you in a way that first and foremost is accurate and makes them feel heard, right? That's the most important. The second most important thing is that as a therapist, you're trying to increase the salience of the parts of, you know, what they're expressing that reflect a desire to change or that reflect a sense of problem recognition, right? So if they tell you that they don't like hangovers, you might say, can you tell me about a recent example of a hangover? What was it like, right? What is it that you don't like about that, right? So you're not, in contrast to like traditional Rogerian client-centered therapy, where you're really just following the client and reflecting essentially everything. With motivational interviewing, you're selectively reflecting content that is going to potentially undergird a desire to change. So that would be content that reflects either a desire to change or a recognition of sort of negative outcomes associated with the target behavior.
Yeah, I think this whole approach is very elegant. And one of the things I love about it the most that you talked about at the beginning and even in here is the idea that you talk to them about what they like about it, right? Like that usually is, in my experience, when I do these types of interventions, totally catches them off guard if this is their first time. Right. They're like, I was expecting you to be like coming in guns a blazing about it's a disaster. It's a train wreck waiting to happen and all this stuff. And it's like, tell me about what you like about it. Like, what's it doing for you? Right. People don't do stuff for no reason.
Yeah.
Right. And this population has a different frame of reference. Most of the people that they're around most of the time aren't experiencing these really heavy duty negative consequences that these videos that you're describing portray. Instead, they're people who are doing, in their view, very similar activities to them. And so when you show them a person like in this video where they're in this descent, right? Like it doesn't even register with them that that's like a plausible outcome and they check out. Right. And then you come in heavy with all the consequences and all that stuff. And they're like, you don't even get me. Right. And so the idea that you come in with this conversation, we're just going to talk about it. Tell me what you like about it. And also tell me a little bit about what you don't like about it. Right. Like usually it comes with some stuff, even if it's just simple stuff like hangovers or, you know, you're missing, assignments or whatever it may be. And then just looking at the connective tissue between those two things, I think it's just really an elegant approach, right? And then selectively catching, right, you know, things that are going to lead to change motivation or motivation to change, right? Oh, hangovers, right? Tell me more about that. What don't you like about it? What's it getting in the way of that you do like?
Yeah.
Right. And then all of a sudden you can really start to feel it in the room as a person starts to, you know, experience change and desire to change.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, Jim, that you've always said in brief motivational or brief interventions that I've watched you do, or that, you know, I've watched other students do, or that I've participated in your lab is, you know, we're going to talk about drinking and, you know, see if there's a way that we can maximize the benefits and to minimize the harms. And I think that's such a way to disarm and a way to let the person know that, you know, you're not trying to interfere with their life or harm them or take anything that, you know, that does benefit them away, but you're instead trying to maximize that and minimize. And this is not, you know, obviously that sentence describes how much of a harm reduction approach this is.
Oh yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, another part of the session where we try to epitomize that is when we provide feedback on blood alcohol content. Mm-hmm. So we'll take their assessment data and they might describe a night where they had 12 drinks over 3 hours, right? And let's say that gives them a blood alcohol level that's really elevated, 0.2 or 0.15 or 0.3. And that's often news to them, right? They really were not aware of that level, that they were at that level of risk. And we let them know what could happen, right? That you know, at that level, you could black out, you know, and you ask about how they felt on that evening, what it was like, what the next day was like. Again, the goal is that you should talk as little as possible, and you should mostly just sort of set up the client or the participant, if it's a research study, to describe their experience. But then we also provide them with similar blood alcohol level feedback for a more moderate night. So we ask about a variety of drinking nights, where they provide us with information. And for almost all of our young adult participants, they have some nights where they have two or three drinks, right? And their peak blood alcohol level is low. It's at a range where they're not significantly impaired. And we ask them about that. What was that night like, right? How did you feel? How did you interact with others? You know, you mentioned that you don't like when you get into arguments. Were there any arguments on that evening, right? How'd you feel the next day?
Yeah.
Right. And so that's another way that we try to really bring out the harm reduction spirit of these brief interventions.
Well, and you know, I guess you could go in with judgment, but as a therapist in that situation, you're just pulling out information about, you know, these different levels of drinking. What is likely to occur when you've had four drinks in an hour, you know, five drinks in an hour? And how does that compare to two drinks in an hour? And, you know, did you get in a fight at this level versus this level? And what if we just found a way for you to still get these benefits and drop that level of drinking down one or two drinks, so that you still have all those good things, but you don't, you know, you aren't more likely to get into a fight. You mentioned this blood alcohol content module. And you know, that is how brief interventions are often sort of structured, is the personalized feedback and then going through different types of feedback with the client or the participant. Can you tell us a little bit more about a few of these types of modules that have been at least common in your work?
Yeah. You mean, like other types of feedback or more?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in addition to blood alcohol level, the single most evidence-based feedback element is called normative feedback, right? Where you find norms that are most close with the participant's reference group. So if it's a college student, if it's a woman, then other college women, right? Or if it's somebody who's not a college student, you might use general population norms, but it helps for the reference group to be part of that person's identity. So you wouldn't want to show somebody who's 18 years old drinking norms for somebody who's 40 years old, right? That's not going to be meaningful to them. Mm-hmm. So, but once you establish the normative group that's most appropriate, you find norms for how much on those that population drinks in the US or whatever country you're working in. And then you let them know their percentile rank relative to other people in that group. And I think this is the most evidence-based piece of feedback. So somebody who drinks, you know, 20 drinks in a week might find out that they drink more than 92%, right, of other people like them. And so getting that information is often It's almost always shocking. It sometimes leads people to shut down. So it can be easily misused, or it can sort of backfire a little bit, especially if there's not good rapport, or if it's delivered in a way that comes with like a gotcha tone, right?
Yeah.
But it also can be very potent, because, as you know, people like to be either average in a positive way or above average. We all think we're at least average or above average in positive traits. And so people typically don't like the idea, especially when they're one-on-one, right? I think if you're in a group of, let's say, college students, there might be some pride in being at the heavy.
Oh, yeah. But yeah.
When
yeah.
it's a one-on-one conversation, I've rarely seen people feel good about being really high. And so this feedback, if used carefully, can really motivate change. But if used sort of haphazardly or without really good motivational interviewing style, can also lead people to shut down, because it's sort of a lot, right? So as an MI therapist, you want to deliver it in a way that is as non-judgmental and as possible. And you also want to be really attuned to the client's reaction. And if you get the sense that they're shutting down, you don't want to pile on with more feedback, especially if it's feedback that has sort of a negative valence. And instead, you want to sort of process that reaction and try to understand how the person is experiencing that feedback.
Yeah, that's a really important point, right? I think you're wanting to gauge the person along the whole path, right? And you're doing these ones where it's like, you know, you versus different times, right? Like, oh, how are you like this? How are you like this? And compare and contrast that. And then you get do this thing where you compare them to others, right? And that can, I think the aggregate part can also, is also really kind of illuminating for them, where you're like, oh, you know, so you drink, you know, 7 drinks a week, which turns into this many drinks a month, this many drinks a year. Sometimes I've seen that technique used before, and they can be like, whoa, I never really thought about it like that. And they're like, and so, you know, when we compare people who are similar to you, that puts you in the 82nd percentile, you know, and then kind of, I think, processing their reaction to like, is that, how does that sit with you? You know, and then is that what you expected? You know, and a lot of times they're like, I thought I was a lot closer to the 50th percentile, right? And you're like, you know, that's interesting, right? And then you can just kind of can get into that part of it versus like, yeah, see, I told you this whole time, I knew you were, right, like secretly drinking way too much, and now I'm going to give you lecture time, right? Like, that's not what you're looking for, right? Like, you get into that, you know, the kind of emotional and cognitive experiences that they have, getting that reflective feedback from, you know, the kind of normative population level stuff. And it can be even really potent too. If some places have like a school specific number, you know, where like, you can be like, people here, right, like drink like this. And then, and you're like, you know, and they're like, wow, I didn't even think about that. And then just kind of making sure you catch it and use it in the right way, I think is a really skillful approach, but also quite challenging. Other stuff, maybe listeners might think this is really easy. This is super challenging to do really skillfully, I think, to catch them, to notice when they have a poor reaction to that normative feedback component, and then catching it and bringing it along to enhance motivation to change versus inhibit motivation to change. I think that's a really challenging thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's some people, there's a lot of different feedback elements, and there is evidence that more feedback is generally better as long as it's personalized right, and not generic. And so other feedback things would be maybe money spent on alcohol aggregated over time, calories from alcohol, you know, feedback on family history risk. So, and there's different hooks for different people, right? Yeah. Some people don't care about how they drink compared to others. And so the good MI great therapist point. Just sort of moves on, right? And even in the beginning, we're going to talk, there's different things that we put together here for you based on what you told us. Some of it may be interesting to you, others may not, and that's fine. We'll just sort of move through it and let me know what interests you. And then you kind of hover over that based on their reaction. But if not, you just move forward.
Yeah. Well, and I think the aggregate point is really critical because most everything we do in life, you know, is not really considered, you know, we don't think about like, oh, well, this is, you know, this is the fifth glass of water I've had today. Or, you know, I think sometimes when we're being health centered, something like that would come to our mind, but often we don't think that way. And it's hard to see the impact over time and really all of what we're doing. So I think that anything that can aggregate the effects from a single drinking night or a pattern of drinking. And I think this is actually going to get a little bit into, you know, maybe some of what we can talk about how you're extending brief interventions, Jim. So I want to hold off on talk about that in a little bit, but I remember some of listening to some sessions when I was really early on. Two comments. Frat boys, you know, would talk about for normative feedback how they couldn't wait to get home and you know, tell their house that they're in the 99th percentile or something like that. So sometimes there might be a moderation effect somewhere in there for something like that. But I remember, you know, a little self-disclosure, when I first filled out the survey, when I first came into your lab, and I was just trying to learn, you know, all about what was going on. I took the survey, I filled it out with my drinking, and I got the feedback. And I was shocked myself, and without talking to a therapist, that changed my drinking dramatically. So I would say that was an effective approach for me personally.
Yeah, no, I wish I had had this in undergrad. To be honest, it's, I think, you know, we'll get to this at some point, but dissemination is just the biggest next step out there. That and sort of enhancing and improving brief interventions, but first and foremost, these things really work. And in particular, if you consider the fact that they've, for the most part, with this young adult population, been tested with people who have no interest in receiving them, right? So that's an important caveat when you've seen some somewhat critical and pessimistic meta-analyses about the effects of brief alcohol interventions. But, you know, the sort of standard for what is an acceptable effect is often what we find with treatments for people who are motivated to reduce their drinking, but, you know, by the fact that they're engaging in a treatment. Well, this is something where we just screen people and provide them with some incentive, or they get in a policy violation and they're mandated to complete an intervention. And it's powerful to get this information. And, you know, the other thing that I think is interesting, sort of going under the hood a little bit. So I've done a number of these trials, and I've been both a therapist, you know, during graduate school and postdoc on one of Nancy Barnett's trials, and then also been a supervisor and a PI on my trials. And we almost always administer like a confidential survey to participants right after they finish the MI session, where they rate their likelihood of change, and they write comments about what they liked and didn't like about the session. And the clinician doesn't see it because it's intended to be like a integrity check of the, you know, how the clinician did. But we listen to the sessions. And so there are a lot of sessions where the participant doesn't express any desire in the session to change or any recognition that this is a problem. So the recalcitrant frat guy that Sam described earlier. And yet, when you read those post-session comments that they wrote confidentially with no incentive to, you know, to make us feel better, they'll say something like, I was blown away by this information.
Yeah.
And I can't believe how much I drank. Right. So I say that just to, for clinicians out there, people are motivated to save face, especially in interpersonal contexts. So there's times, and drinking is a stigmatized behavior, as is other drug use. And we are often in a position of power vis-a-vis our role, you know, as a therapist or a researcher or grad student when we meet with clients. And so they may not always express in the room a recognition that this is sinking in, but the data suggests that it does, right? So I think that's just an important thing. Don't feel bad, and don't keep pushing if you feel like there's resistance. Maybe the resistance is just part of the interpersonal context.
Yeah, I think sometimes people are sitting on it and they resist and they think about it a lot later. And the other part
that's a good point
that makes it different between, you know, like the effect size smaller is that you're sitting with this person typically for I think most interventions are an hour long. You don't need a doctoral level therapist to do a brief intervention necessarily. You know, it kind of feels in some ways like you're getting more bang for your buck, even though the effect size might be, you know, relatively small.
Yeah. Well, and also think about what's the control group, right? Even when it's assessment only, what is assessment? It's filling out all the same information that you're getting back in the feedback.
Yeah.
So that's actually a really potent control group when your intervention is a 1 hour intervention that largely entails summarizing your drinking.
Well, right.
When you did the assessment, you just did that. So any effect of BMI is over and above essentially the information that you get in the session.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's something that people often lose as well.
Yeah. I think that's and it's also, I think, just like there are effects about the types of change that can even be possible. Like some people come in and they don't drink a lot overall, but they have kind of risky drinking profiles, right? Where they like binge drink, for instance, or, you know, have blackout drinking. And we're going to do some stuff around that. And, you know, the overall change in their drinking isn't huge, right? But their risk profile changes dramatically, which isn't always captured or I think reflected in some of the effect sizes that usually we look at, right? Quantity or frequency of drinking,
right,
or these types of things. And I think also, I think the context of the population, I think is part of that, right? Like I was an interventionist on a trial with Chris Kaler and Tyler Ray at Brown. And we were trying to do a thing where more visual with it, where we made, like, instead of saying like you drink this much stuff, like we brought out how much alcohol they drank. Like in like a month. That's it was cool. Like, this is how much you drank in a month.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. And just like let it on the table, you know, like to see how it worked. And like, these were people who weren't recruited, who were interested in changing or any of that kind of stuff. And we just sent them a survey like a couple months later and just asked them how they were drinking, not have you changed, any of that kind of stuff. And a bunch of people changed their drinking in meaningful ways just from, you know, just like this visual representation of it. Right. So it's just about trying to allow them to start thinking about this. And many of them haven't, right? Outside of, oh, this is such a hassle, I have to go to this appointment, right? Yeah. Like, they thought about that a great deal sometimes, some of the time, but usually it's like, you know, just think a little bit about what's going on here. And I think that's really important to think that, well, many of these people aren't even motivated to change at all. And so the fact that they changed, right, any a part of their drinking or their risk profile is a huge effect, right? Like, you're actually overcoming like systematic barriers to your effect, right? And I think that it gets underplayed in it when you compare it to people who are like motivated to come in and in these trials that are like, oh, I need to change, all this negative consequences are happening, or like, it's just a totally different change profile.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great point. And I want to kind of reiterate your point about how the whole goal of the session might be reducing your drinking on those peak nights by one or two drinks, which
can
be the difference between an arrest and not an arrest, or blackout and not blackout.
Totally.
And it is really hard to detect an effect at an aggregate level.
Yes.
When that is your goal, but that is absolutely your goal. And that is absolutely an important and relevant goal with this population.
And maybe not even a drinking reduction goal. Maybe you're asking them to start drinking a cup of water in between each drink, right? And that just reduces overall BAC. And
I've done that exact thing in clinical work, right? Like, the person wasn't interested in stop drinking or these kinds of things. And all we just tried to figure out with the BAC was, at what point did you lose contact? They were blacking out. What point did you kind of, where the memories get foggy? Where do you start to brown out and things like that? And we could calculate their BAC based on what they were drinking at those stages. And we say, how about we stay in this zone right here? Right. And then we spread it out with, you know, some protective behavioral strategies like water between them. Right. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you know, only so many over a certain amount of time. And then, you know, that ultimately accrue, you know, maybe was like 2 drink difference in the night. Right. And then when you take that on the aggregate, you know, it's a really small change, but was really meaningful to that person because they weren't having these blackouts anymore. And that's a very potent, I think, change. And also these things are like, how many sessions, Jim, do you usually do in a brief motivational context?
The traditional format is 1 in-person session. Some of the work we've done has added a second session. And I think that that could be time well spent, but yes, it's very brief.
I think that's the key, right? The B in the BMI, right, is brief, which is 1 50-minute session a lot of these times, right? And part of that is like, you know, filling out paperwork and doing all kinds of stuff, right? And so compared to, you know, gold standard treatments or 12 sessions, 15 sessions,
right,
things like that, you know, weekly with people. And so when you're, that's a horse race that's just not, you know, necessarily fair.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
right.
And you know, like in IAAA, the college AIM, which just sort of measures effectiveness of different treatments for college students. It rates it as high effectiveness, low cost. It's great intervention overall.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. But you know, there are some limitations to it. Can you talk to us a little bit about the limitations that you see in brief interventions as they stand, and then some of the work that you've been doing to actually address some of those limitations?
Yeah, happy to. So some of what we've found and other people have found, folks like Kate Carey and Jen Merrill that have looked at predictors of response to brief intervention, is that these approaches work well, but to students with some other risk factors like lower levels of alcohol-free positive activities and sort of reward, and also comorbidity or high levels of impulsivity, there's some evidence that those students are less likely to respond positively to BMIs, right? It's not conclusive. And there are other studies that suggest that folks with elevated depressive symptoms do respond. But so what we tried to do is, and others have now done this in different ways, is to try to think about a way that's still brief that we could augment BMIs. And I think there's 2 critical ways that BMIs need to be improved. One is they need to be attached to other approaches that provide sort of a foot in the door in terms of getting young people to want to engage in the overall experience, right? So we've developed a substance-free activity session that's all about increasing awareness of future goals and increasing positive activities. But other people like Lisa Fusito from Yale have developed sleep-based intervention where it's all about enhancing sleep. And oh, by the way, we're tacking on the alcohol content, right, as well, because people won't present for alcohol, but they will for sleep, right? People will be more interested in, you know, an approach that helps them address their goals or improve their mood. The other way that they need to be improved is that there are many people that will leave a BMI session motivated to drink less, right? But their ability to follow through is limited because, again, if you're high in impulsivity, if you have a lot of negative affect, if you have a lot of anxiety, or if your drinking is really severe, there's often a disconnect between your verbal behavior, statements of wanting to change, and your ability to change, right? And so I think a session where it's, if you could add 1 session, which is what we've done with this substance-free activity session, where instead of trying to reduce the problem behavior, drinking, right? I think about that as the whack-a-mole approach, right? Where like the carnival game where the mole pops up and you're trying to push it down, right? Even though BMIs are very positive and we're not hitting people over the head with this, at the end of the day, we are telling them to reduce a problem behavior, a behavior that we view that can be problematic, but for them is mostly good, right? Rather than what is actually easier, if you look at behavioral change theory and a lot of other health behavior change research, rather than increasing a positive behavior that is to some extent incompatible mm-hmm. with the negative behavior and will be sort of a natural substitute for that behavior.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the idea behind this behavioral economic approach of the substance-free activity session is let's have one more session where we help the young adult identify what's important to them, what their goals are, what they enjoy doing when they're not drinking or using drugs, and help instead of motivating them to drink less, motivate them to engage in the positive behavior more, and trust that even if their desire to drink doesn't change at all, if you merely increase a positive behavior like exercise or studying or community service or engagement with their church or some other organization, that will indirectly reduce drinking, right? So that's kind of the basic idea behind this.
This is, I think, such an important point. And obviously, for anybody who's listened to the show before, something that is like really, like I find personally important to me, which is the idea of just understanding a person's positive emotional life. And I don't think we pay enough attention to that idea that we're asking them to remove something without replacing it with something that's equal or better in inducing positive emotions for them. This is a very reliable, certain, immediate positive reinforcer for them, right? Like I go have a drink with my friends, I feel better. I feel good. I might not necessarily feel bad, but no matter what I'm feeling, I usually feel better, right? It enhances that. And a lot of times when we ask them to reduce their drinking, or we're talking to them about reducing drinking, there's nothing to really fill in that space. And the idea that we can help them to curate a life that has these alternative, right, substance-free reinforcers that are, you know, kind of incompatible with drinking at times to offset, right, this change and allow their life to just have a little bit different distribution of activities, but still have the same kind of overall emotional profile, I think is really an important, like, adaptation to brief motivational interviewings. But just in general, I think what addiction treatment and substance use related behavior change should be considering, because I think we often miss that along the way. So I'm really, really excited to hear that you're doing that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's incredibly intuitive, right? And and again, it's when I thought about this, I was borrowing from the work that Steve Higgins and others have done. Mm-hmm. Happy to hear you're going to have Steve on soon.
Can't wait, yeah.
Contingency management. And I was borrowing from ideas that were developed in behavioral activation approaches mm-hmm. and ACT a little yeah. bit, but that had never been put in this motivational interviewing framework and really had been neglected in the brief intervention literature.
Yeah.
So my goal was just to sort of take this general behavioral idea that that alcohol use functions as a substitute, that there are other positive behavior categories that could substitute for alcohol use, yeah. right? And that people are way more interested in talking about those things, right?
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
if you can increase those things, you will facilitate change in drinking. And even if you don't, you will facilitate positive development in some
yeah. way. In many yes. ways, you brought the motivational interviewing spirit. You MI'd BMIs, you know, you because like the BMI, like the purpose was still to reduce drinking. And now I think the purpose is to help people live like with the SFAS is to help them live a more meaningful life. And hopefully that's sort of an offshoot of an offshoot outcome of that is to reduce drinking as well. So can you tell us a little bit about like I'm asking this like I don't know. I worked on the study, a little bit about the outcomes, what you found with this new session and where you're going with it.
Yeah. So, we did one study. The first study was a pilot study in R21 where, we found that when you add the substance-free activity session to a BMI, you get a better outcome than if you have a BMI plus an individual relaxation session. right? That was a small trial with two groups. So BMI plus individual relaxation, which at the time we viewed as a sort of inert control for contact, clinician contact. So the BMI plus SFAS in that study reduced drinking and alcohol problems in particular, more so than the BMI plus relaxation. So I think at the time that was the first study to show that you could actually augment BMI in a way that improved outcomes. Because other studies had tried to give people more alcohol-focused BMI via boosters or other sessions, and generally those were not effective beyond just the standard one session BMI. So then we did a larger trial, and the results were slightly different in that this time we had the same two conditions, BMI plus relaxation and BMI plus SFAS, but then we also had an assessment only control. And the effects of BMI plus SFAS, and this was a much longer, larger sample, two different universities, 16 month follow-up. And the results of the BMI plus SFAS were as large or even slightly larger than the first trial, and they endured throughout the 16 months. But this time they were generally equal to the BMI plus relaxation, but both conditions generated reductions in drinking and problems that were quite a bit larger than what we found in our lab and other folks have found with single session BMI conditions. So what that suggests is that it doesn't have to be an SFAS that you add to BMI. It could also be this individual session where you meet with a clinician, you learn about diaphragmatic breathing, you learn about progressive muscle relaxation, and you actually do it in the session. And it's interesting that there was about 5 years separating these trials. And during that time, we had the ascendance of mindfulness sort of in our popular culture and in our clinical world. And I think, you know, generally maybe increasing levels of stress among young adults. And so it seemed like our students were much more engaged and much more showed a better reaction to BMI plus relaxation than they did in the first trial. So I think what we learned was that either of those two session approaches works really well, and it works for at least 16 months.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's a really interesting finding, that you can just systematically sort of increase the effect and how long it lasts. I mean, that's it's a long time.
Talking about two sessions, right? That probably happened like what, maybe a week apart?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So two weeks, right? 2 hours probably total, right? Had a lasting effect for 16 months.
16 months, yeah. There was a brief 15-minute phone booster as well. But yeah, essentially.
But even still, maybe 2 hours and 15 minutes
right.
spent with a person yeah. to have lasting positive change in young people's lives, I think is just, that's just astounding.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. You know, and both conditions also reduced depressive symptoms, improved, self-regulation, and those effects were mediated by increases in positive activities that actually occurred in both conditions. So, so I think that's an important
kind
of mechanism of change. And, you know, anecdotally, what we saw a lot were that some people, so the first session was BMI, then the second session was SFAS or relaxation. And there were some people who ended the BMI session very, very much sort of content with their drinking and, you know, not hostile. We rarely see people who are sort of, you know, hostile or openly critical in the BMI session, but we do see a lot, about half are just like, no, I'm fine how I am. Right. And that's okay. Right. You summarize that, you move on. Well, then in the SFAS session, in particular, the part of the SFAS where we plot people's time allocation using a pie chart, and we let them know how much time they spend in a typical week drinking or recovering from the effects of drinking, which we factor in based on how many drinks they have and the amount of time it takes your body to metabolize alcohol, versus the time they spend exercising or engaging in studying if they're a student, or other family activities, sort of spiritual activities. And we sort of show them this objective chart that maps out their lifestyle. And then we ask them how this fits with their goals and values, right? Many people who were completely impervious to the alcohol specific feedback in session one, when they see alcohol framed as part of their overall pattern of behavior, their jaw's on the floor and they're like, this doesn't fit with my goals at all, right? And we almost never see resistance to that feedback. I think that's one of the more potent elements of the SFAS.
That's a clear behavioral economic influence is this time allocation approach, because some of the really hardcore, you know, behavioral economists would say that you are sort of who you are is how you spend your time, right? And so when people see that and they see that they have this idea of who they want to be and what they want to be, especially in college, when you're sort of looking towards the future, you want to become a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. And you see that's a big part of your time is not spent doing that, but instead is spent drinking. I think that can be a real startling, you know, almost identity thing. So I particularly love that aspect of the SFAS, and I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the part also that in some ways is most unique. In terms of, you don't see that in behavioral activation or ACT or other similar approaches that I'm aware of. And I have to credit Rudy Vucinich, who had the idea to do that way back when he did this first basics trial. And as you know, he's
figures
in behavioral economics. And him and Jay Lee Tucker have always tried to understand people's sort of valuation of activities, alcohol and non-alcohol, by understanding how they spend their time, right? And so that's sort of where that idea came from. And I should also note, you know, we've applied, the SFAS is not just for college students. Lydia Meshesha, when she was in my lab, she's now at University of Central Florida doing great things. Her F31 dissertation adapted the SFAS for an adult alcohol use disorder treatment population, where she added the SFAS to standard intensive outpatient care and found benefits there. And so this is not just with students. We're doing a trial now where we're doing this with with young adults who are not 4-year college students, which are a very high risk,
huge
and understudied group. So So I think that's just a general important clinical tool. I could see that being helpful for somebody who's trying to make any sort of lifestyle change or enhance their mood or any sort of positive change.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for going through that. Really glad you mentioned, you know, these other populations that, you know, we know that they're effective with. And and I'm really looking for, I know you're looking forward to get that clinical trial off the ground. I'm looking forward to seeing the results and also seeing this applied to a population with already, you know, where there's already health disparities, and then where brief interventions have not been introduced yet. So that'll be a cool thing, an important thing, to be part of this, you know, seminal introduction to a new population that desperately needs stuff like that. We really appreciate the time you've given us today, sort of coming to a conclusion. We always like to ask our guests to deliver some take-home messages, you know, for specific stakeholder groups. And, you know, these brief, 30-second responses, just to summarize everything that we talked about today. So what do you think the take-home message is for people who are in recovery? That's the question we typically ask, but people who might be getting one of these brief interventions is sort of the idea.
Yeah. Well, let me first say, for people in recovery, I think that it's important to organize your life around your recovery, but more specifically around pursuing patterns of activities that generate reward, that provide meaning, that provide structure, and in particular, social contact, which I think, as much attention as it's received in our literature, it still has not received enough attention. I think social reward is probably the most important substitute for drug-related reward. you know, I always tell clients to avoid the sort of the white knuckle approach to recovery. It's not about enduring the aversiveness, that's part of it, but it's more about building a life worth living. And so I think that, and I also want to mention a book that's about to come out by Jay Lee Tucker and Katie Witkowitz. We have a chapter in there about sort of building a life worth living. So I think that's sort of the key message for people in recovery. For young adults, I think the key message is just consider how alcohol fits in your overall lifestyle and your goals, and consider how you might minimize harm, right? And how you might maximize the benefits, but minimizing some of the risks, and how you might feel a sense of social connection without alcohol, and how that might not be quite as easy initially, but over time does generally get easier.
What would you say to practitioners listening?
So I think I would encourage all practitioners. I know we mostly get addiction folks listening to this. So, but for those not doing addiction work, I think just initiating discussions about alcohol and drug use with all of your clients. We're getting better about this as a field, but we still generally neglect.
It's the thing you avoid. Yeah.
Oh, seriously. Yeah. Seriously. Yeah.
It's a real issue. But for people in the addiction field, I think A, being open to harm reduction, and B, really getting behind this idea of helping your clients to build a life worth living and seeing that as part of addiction treatment, right? It's not, coping skills are great. We need them, but it's not just about skills to help you not drink or use drugs. It's as much about skills to help you develop other ways of finding reward and meaning. Mm-hmm. Both of those things should be sort of co-equal goals.
Yeah. Yeah. Sustainable, right? Like reliable, like alternatives, right? Are just so, I think, so crucial here.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. What would you say to policymakers?
So this is bold, but I actually feel like we are in a time right now where it is really a space for bold policy moves, because we're at sort of a low point as a, as a democracy, and now as a health-wise after the pandemic. But I think we need some way to have a universal sort of behavioral or lifestyle check-in with emerging adults in our society. It's a group that's really struggling. Those years are the gateway to adulthood. About 45% of young adults attend college, so that is a natural place to do this. You know, the rest don't. So we need other mechanisms for reaching these people. Right? Not just primary care. I think primary care is great. I love that we're more in primary care, but we need some systematic way of having a probably interpersonally framed, like meaning counselor or trained lay support person, way of just checking in with young people about their lifestyle and their mood and their alcohol and drug use in a way that uses these MI principles. And I think there would be tremendous public health benefit to that.
Yeah. Something about that sounds very Swiss. It's like very Swiss policy, and you know, God forbid we're ever as happy as the Swiss. So,
yes. You know,
yeah. What would you say to underserved populations?
So I think one thing that I've tried to advocate, and I know Sam has as well in our research together, is this idea that a lot of what we call psychopathology, and you know, that includes addiction, is really driven by reward deprivation. So we in psychology historically and in medical models focus on internal causes of suffering. Which I think is incorrect and inadequate, given that most suffering is about being in a context that is deprived of essential reward, whether that is basic needs or whether that is social connection or whether that is gainful employment or educational opportunities. And so people who are in marginalized groups, people who are experience poverty, people who are racial, sexual, or gender minorities are often deprived in at many levels, both because of discrimination and oppression and historical systemic racism and poverty. And so as psychologists, we need to think in more contextual ways and not focus as much on internal risk factors as much as contextual risk factors. And I think reward deprivation is sort of a transdiagnostic risk factor and natural mechanism of change across interventions that could really help to mitigate health disparities.
Yeah, very, very well said. I think that's an important thing. And we spend a lot of time in our field on internal causes, and we're learning more and more of that, you know, where you are and how the kind of environment that you live in and the type of things that you experience, you know, externally are huge determinants on the types of behaviors that you end up engaging in. So thank you for bringing up that point. We've really appreciated this, Jim. I get to hear this all the time. It's been awesome to hear, and I'm sure our listeners are going to get so much out of this. Final question for you. You've been really successful, and you've developed a really successful program of research. Do you have any advice for trainees or early career people out there?
Yeah. So I think for, first of all, thank you. And I really enjoyed this conversation as well. And I appreciate all that, that you are doing with this podcast. I love it. So for students and trainees, be patient, right? I didn't love addiction when I was first exposed to it. I was a little bit intimidated by, I was a lot intimidated by behavioral economics, and especially an advisor who was incredibly sort of quantitatively based and theoretically based. And it took me a while to latch on to parts of that that I could understand and apply. And so be patient. The more you invest in reading and understanding our science and our practice, the more it will become enjoyable and sustaining. But that doesn't happen overnight. Make your science and your training as social as possible. We need connection. It is as much as I love writing, I love the work that we do, it's unsustainable to do that, try to do it by yourself all the time. You've got to find ways to make this social and communal, whether that's writing with people, talking with people. Academic Twitter, I think, is a great way to do this. Mm-hmm. Very soon, attending conferences will be a way to do this again. And then also for students, you know, pursue your passion, but also really make a conscious effort to connect your passion with public health interests. I mean, ultimately, we're servants of public health, and it's not just about indulging our curiosities, right? It's or publishing papers, right? Or, you know, generating new models. It's about improving public health. And I think mm-hmm. we have to continually retether ourselves to public health. And if we do that, ultimately, I think we'll have success. But also frustration is part of it. I mean, I've had tons of grants and papers rejected, and it's early on, it really hurts. I remember as a postdoc, when a couple of my postdoc really talented classmates, like Brian Borsari and Tim Apodaca, had grants funded and mine wasn't, I remember just having a meltdown, right? And that's part of it. And it's just, it's a process. Everybody gets rejected. Just keep going. And finally, I would say, read outside of your area. Read general science as much as you can. Read lab research as much as you can if you're clinical. And that is, I think, a good way also to address big picture questions.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you, Jim. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. This has been really great. I hope our listeners love it as much as I did, because I really love talking about these things. So thank you so much for spending some time with us.
No problem. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah.
Next time on The Addiction Psychologist, we'll have Dr. Catherine McHugh join us. Kate is an associate professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and an associate psychologist at the Center of Excellence in Alcohol, Drugs, and Addiction at McLean Hospital. Kate will be talking to us about cognitive behavioral therapy for substance use disorder.